Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rombacher.
And I'm really looking forward to what's on today's episode. What's on the menu, Brian?
Well, we're going to hear from a mix of RTB scholars and visiting scholars, including philosopher and theologian Ken Samples, pastor and theologian Gavin Ortlund, and more.
Well, they will be addressing a variety of topics, including the apologetics of beauty and is death in creation evil? It's a good question.
It is. Yeah. Plus, we're going to hear from visiting scholar Eddie Del Rio in our next segment on how faith impacts the practice of medicine.
That'll be fun, too. Before our first segment, though, we wanted to let you know about a new, simple, yet potentially powerful tool for your personal outreach.
That's right. We got brand new conversation cards that help introduce people to the harmony we see in scripture and science about the beginning of the universe.
And for the month of January, you can receive these cards as a thank you for your gift of any amount. To get your cards, just visit reasons.org/2819.
All right, and now on to the show. First up, we have RTB 101. Krista Bontrager will talk with astrophysicist Jeff Swearing, answering the question, was light created in transit?
Let's check it out.
Now it's time for RTB 101, where we discuss practical questions to equip you to share your faith more effectively. And here to help me talk about a Christian perspective on the speed of light is astrophysicist Dr. Jeff Swearing. Welcome back, Jeff.
Krista, it's good to be here. Always enjoy.
Now, we at Reasons to Believe hold to kind of the mainstream age for the universe. So maybe we should start there. Is like, mm-hmm. How old is the universe anyways?
Yeah, we do. We think the scientists largely have the timing of things correct. And so we think the universe is about 14 billion years old. Earth's about 4.5 billion years old. Humanity's a few hundred thousand years old at the most. So
now there's a lot of different ways that we arrive at the age of the universe. And we're mm-hmm. just going to talk about one of the ways.
Right.
And these are kind of multiple independent lines of evidence. But one of the lines of evidence is the issue of light travel mm-hmm. time. So maybe you could give us a little crash course on how this works and how this help scientists know how old the universe is.
Well, as Hugh's fond of saying, astronomers know nothing about the present. All we know is about the past. And it's just the same phenomena as when you go out and look at a thunderstorm. You look out there, you see the lightning, you wait and you count, and you can tell how long the thunder gets there, and that tells you how far away the object is. Well, that's because the speed of sound is much less than the speed of light. So it looks like the light happens instantaneously, and then you can tell how long it takes the sound to travel here. Well, when you're looking out across the distances of space, light actually has a finite speed, and so light takes a long time to travel. So it takes about 1 second for the light to get from the moon to the Earth, takes about 8.5 minutes from the sun to the Earth, and you get out to the Andromeda Galaxy, you're 2.5 million years now for the light to get from the Andromeda Galaxy to us. So it's a way of measuring how far away things are and what's gone on and how far into the past are we looking.
So when I hear on the news that some star is 3 billion light years away, what that's telling me is that the light was traveling for 3 billion years before we saw it here on Earth.
Yeah, and there's a little ambiguity as you get further away because, 3 billion light years away, really what they're saying is that light has been traveling for 3 okay. billion years. It's taken the light that long to get here. And so when you get away a little further, it gets a little more complicated, but that's effectively what it means.
Okay, so now I immediately can see a bit of a conundrum here because some of my Christian friends believe that the universe is only thousands of years old, mm-hmm. and yet you're telling me that the Andromeda Galaxy is millions of light years away.
Right.
So how do we begin to, how do you hear Christians try to get around the light travel problem?
Well, in the past, some of the argument was just things aren't that far away. But as we've kind of grown in our ability to make measurements, even our galaxy is roughly 100,000 light years across. So light from the other edge of the galaxy would take more than 100,000 years to reach us. But once you get out to more distant things, clearly you're millions and billions of light years away. And so one of the arguments that has been made is say, God created these things to be seen. So when he created them in the creation week, he put their light in transit. So we're not seeing light having traveled that far. We're seeing the light beams, just kind of the front end of them, if you will, so that we can actually see what's going on, because it wouldn't do us any good to know about stars if we couldn't see them. So they were basically, the light was created in transit is the terminology used.
So another way I've heard it said is God kind of made the light on its way.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so now we're both Christians here, and we know that God is a God of miracles. He can do anything. Mm-hmm. Couldn't that be the way that God did that?
Well, I mean, yes, if it's a statement of what could God do, God's the one in charge. He gets to create how he so chooses, as long as he's consistent with his character. The question is not what could God do, but what did God do? And so if God did create light in transit, presumably as we would measure it, we would see evidence of that's what it is. And the problem is when we look at light, we see evidence that it's actually traveled that far as well. So that would you kind of get into this inconsistency where what we measure isn't reflective of what God's done. And that leads to kind of a bad theology, or gives us a bad picture of who God is.
Well, it would be a little peculiar if I'm going out and I'm making measurements, if I can't even trust my measurements.
Yes.
And yet God tells me in Psalm 19 and Romans 1 that he has declared his glory through creation. So I would kind of intuitively expect it to be a reliable mm-hmm. revelation of who he is. And then when I went out and measured things, I would get reliable results. So that
right.
seems a little peculiar if we're measuring things, but it's not
a reliable not,
not yeah. accurate.
Well, and even, you know, you get into a little bit of detail here is, you know, I studied a galaxy when I was in graduate school. It was Markarian 421. It's a galaxy that's 400 million light years away from us. And so I would say the light has been traveling to us for 400 million years. But in the mid-90s, there was this time where the particular light I was looking at, which were gamma rays, was at this baseline level, and it jumped way up a factor of about 30, and then it dropped back down in a relatively short period of time. Now, if God created light in transit, that would work if all we saw is this steady stream of light. But this, where it jumped up and down, that's a signature of an event that happened on that object. Mm. And so if God created the light in transit, he created in transit this record of an event that never happened.
That's even more peculiar.
Yes, it becomes very problematic. So it's there are people used to say, well, God created the fossils in the ground too. That, like I said, you get into this place where you're impugning the character of God if you're not really careful how you say that.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. Now, my non-Christian friends, how would they be likely to respond to the idea that God just made light on its way? Like, if I were to use that argument with a non-Christian friend, it's sort of an appearance of age argument. Mm-hmm. How would they likely hear that? How would they respond?
Well, I mean, if I were that, or my guess is what they would say is at least two things. One, it sounds very ad hoc. It's like, you know, if we want to go out and study the universe, to just kind of throw in, oh, this is the way it is. And it's like, there's no way to test that or what's going on. It's like, it just seems very ad hoc. Why are you doing that? It's almost like you're making up things to say the Bible's true instead of pointing towards the evidence, pointing towards the Bible being true. The other aspect of it, and it's what you alluded to, is like, if God just made everything in transit, when we're making measurements of what's going on out there, what are we measuring? Because it's now no longer a record of what's actually happened. And so, you know, you're undermining, you're kind of throwing in this ad hoc idea, and ultimately you're undermining the field of astronomy and astrophysics and all this sort of stuff. And so that would, you know, if I were a non-Christian and I liked science, that would be a big red flag that, okay, there's something wrong here.
Very good. Well, thanks for helping us kind of work that through a little bit. And I do want to encourage you, go check out Jeff's blog. It's called Impact Events at reasons.org. Next up, we're going to watch a clip from our visiting scholar, Dr. Eddie Del Rio, talking about how the Christian faith impacts his practice of medicine. Let's check it out.
Today, I'm joined by Dr. Eddie Del Rio, a medical doctor and a Christian. And we're going to ask Eddie, how has your faith impacted your work as a scientist and physician?
Well, as a physician to begin with, or I should say as a scientist, my subject are human beings. And as a Christian, I believe that human beings are image bearers. That means I approach every one of my patients with the respect of understanding I'm engaging with someone who bears the image of God is their representative. What their relationship to God is really doesn't matter. I have a duty to engage them as another image bearer. Secondly, I would say that as a Christian, I believe that one day I'm going to meet my maker. I'm going to meet my creator and have to give an account for what I have done in life. Therefore, the things that I do, I have to remember, are going to be reviewed in the ultimate peer review ever. Finally, I'm called to do excellent work. In the book of Colossians, it tells Christians, whatever you do, do it as unto Christ with excellence. Now, I don't claim that Christians have the corner of the market in caring for others or doing excellent work, just saying that I have that extra motivation in my work. Finally, I would say that my knowledge of science and my Christian faith kind of dovetail together to give me a vibrant appreciation for God's handiwork in nature. I'm thinking of his creativity, intricacy and complexity of the things that I see make my soul thrive. And basically, I see his fingerprint in nature in every direction that I look.
That's fabulous, Eddie. And I think you've actually written some blogs that are available on the Reasons website, reasons.org, where you actually talk about some of the design and the intricacy and complexity that you see.
Yes, AJ, in several of those blogs, essentially what I do is I say, let's look at something man has invented, the parts, the interconnectedness, the functionality. And then I say, look at this in the human body. It's exactly the same. And so it's an argument by inference. Since we know that these things that man has invented are a product of intelligent agency, it actually becomes a rational inference to say maybe that in our human body is also the product of intelligent agency.
And those arguments from inference is what science is all about.
In fact, Darwin's book was one big book on inference and abductive reasoning, basically. So we're treading well-trod paths when we use this kind of reasoning.
For more on this topic, go to reasons.org and search Eddie Del Rio. Now it's time for Culture Talk, where we discuss culturally relevant topics and how you can use them to start conversations about your faith. I'm joined today with philosopher and theologian Ken Samples. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Sandra.
I want to talk to you about a recent blog that you wrote, and it's on the aesthetic and beauty as being a best explanation for God. And one of the things that you mention is that Vatican Museum benefactors actually say that their mission is to promote evangelism through beauty. Before we dive into kind of beauty, though, can we discuss what that means? Like, what do we what does beauty mean?
Yeah, well, I was very pleased when I saw the Vatican emphasizing that, because obviously the Vatican Library contains some of the greatest works of art in history, Michelangelo, all of these remarkable artists, and they see this as communicating more than just aesthetic elements. It's communicating kind of the Christian worldview. So beauty is something that grips all of us. I mean, regardless of whether you believe in God or not, all of us see beauty in literature, music, the arts, and oftentimes people base their whole life around it.
Right, yeah, you know, and what your article is explaining is really kind of what we understand as beauty and as aesthetic. So can we dive into then what we mean by aesthetic?
Yeah, aesthetics has to do with beauty, taste, and art. Mm-hmm. And it raises all kinds of important questions. Mm-hmm. Is beauty only in the eyes of the beholder? Mm-hmm. Is there an objective basis for beauty? And why are we gripped by beauty? What is it about the human being that they appreciate it the way they do?
Right, and one of the things that you explain is that beauty actually reflects then our worldview. And how does that work?
Yeah, well, you know, a worldview is like a cluster of our most important beliefs, our view of God, our view of the universe, our view of morality. But a part of that worldview that often is not talked about enough is how about that aesthetic side? Why is that there? Mm-hmm. Why do human beings make such an important emphasis of it? And so I would say that's a critical part alongside things like morality and right. other important issues.
So from maybe like a naturalistic or evolutionary perspective, yeah. how would we understand beauty and how that even developed and human appreciation for yeah. beauty?
Well, I think that's a very interesting mm-hmm. apologetic question, because for many people, beauty seems non-utilitarian. That is, mm-hmm. it doesn't appear to contribute toward human survivability as a species. So people have then raised the question, why is there so much beauty in the world? Why do we have human beings that can detect it if evolution is driven by survivability? Now, I should mention there are evolutionists, there are atheists mm-hmm. who say maybe beauty contributes to survivability in that, you know, in a female bird may be attracted by color and maybe there are elements. I would simply say there's no clear support for the idea that beauty plays a critical part in survivability, which then opens up the door, is there another and a better right. explanation?
So then from a Christian perspective, how do we look at yeah. beauty and why humans are able to appreciate beauty?
I think that's such an important mm-hmm. issue, Sandra. God is not just a creator and an engineer. He mm-hmm. is all of that, but he's also an artist. Mm-hmm. That is, God has created the universe with an abundance of beauty, mm-hmm. beauty in the things that we see, beauty in what we hear. Mm-hmm. But he's also created human beings in his image. And so when people, Michelangelo, Raphael, all of these wonderful painters, when they create works of art, they're reflecting that image mm-hmm. that God has given them. And right. so I argue in my piece that the best explanation for beauty in the world and beauty reflected in human beings is that God is behind it as the ultimate playful artist, if you
right.
will.
Oh, and I love thinking of God as a playful artist.
Yeah.
As someone who I think is creative. I love just imagining God yeah. being a creator, and then because we're made in his image, then we are yeah. created to create. And I think that's so inspiring for anyone yeah. Who is interested in the arts. Now, it isn't just Christians, though, who see sure. that beauty and human appreciation for it actually kind of points to God. You mentioned in your article about some non-theists who yeah. also point that out. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, I know non-Christians. They're mm-hmm. they're atheists. Right. But when they go to an art museum, Sandra, that's like a temple to them.
Yeah.
They're so attracted by it. It raises the question, and I quote a skeptical philosopher in my piece, Paul Draper, who's a leading philosopher. He says that a world that has an abundance of beauty and people who can appreciate beauty weighs in favor of theism over mm-hmm. atheism.
Yeah.
So even skeptical philosophers see this as a potential pointer to God.
Right. Well, and I think that's wonderful. I think it's great and a kind of an open door for us then, because we all as humans appreciate
oh, yeah.
beauty and aesthetic value. So, you know, we can appreciate that together, and we can also maybe encourage people to ponder the origin of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, wonderful.
Very good.
Thank you so much for that, Ken. If you want to hear more from Ken Samples, visit reasons.org and search Reflections. Now we're going to head over to Give and Take and see what Jeff Zwerink's up to.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink here, and welcome back to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific ideas to help you be more confident in the truth of Christianity. Today I'm excited because we have Dr. Gavin Ortlund back, and we are going to be discussing whether death in creation is a good thing or not. Gavin, it's good to have you back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Again, I just appreciate your background in historical theology. That's where mm-hmm. you have a PhD. I know you're a pastor, mm-hmm. First Baptist Church in Ojai. Right. I know those two things you've got to have wrestled with, the length of creation days and death before the fall and these sorts of things. So how do we think about death before the fall? I know that's not something recently that's talked about, and I know people have talked about that throughout history. So what insight can you bring to that discussion?
Yeah, well, I think for starters, I would say this is one of the most emotional parts of this debate mm-hmm. over creation. And yeah. some, in some ways, it's where you get into where the deeper issues lie about how do we understand createdness and fallenness? Because mm-hmm. some people would look at a lion eating a gazelle and say, that's why the world is fallen. That's evil.
Right.
Other people would say, actually, that's the way God set it up to work, and that's not necessarily evil. It may mm-hmm. be unpleasant for the gazelle in the moment.
Right.
But it's not necessarily evil. So,
it seems to have this implication of God's character. It's like, how could God do that? That can't be the God we serve type things.
Yeah, yeah. And there's sometimes strong judgments made upon mm-hmm. those behaviors as though if that were the way God set up the world, God himself would be the author of evil.
Right.
And
right.
so this issue does get into some pretty important implications in terms of how we view God and how we understand what creation is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you've done some work studying Augustine, and he's a prominent theologian who's influenced a lot of the theology that Orthodox Christendom thinks about today, or that is Orthodox thought in Christendom today. What did Augustine have to say about this?
Yeah, he's a fun person to engage on this. He talked a lot about insects.
Okay.
And a lot about carnivores.
Okay.
And basically was very strong in his assertion that these are good things that God made. And and he actually rebukes those who sit in judgment upon them.
Hmm.
And part of that comes from his own historical context. He lived in the 4th and 5th centuries. And there was a religion called Manichaeism back
okay.
in those days. And the
Is that a sect of Christianity or is that something entirely different?
It's outside of Orthodox Christianity.
Outside of Orthodox Christianity.
Yeah. Okay. So the Manichaeans, they were dualists. They believe good and evil are kind of equal cosmically, and they think that animal death is a bad thing, and so they're sitting in judgment upon this as an example of why the world wasn't good and why Genesis 1, saying the world was good, is wrong.
Okay.
And so he's responding to them, mm-hmm. and in the context of that response, he has a lot to say about how some things can appear unpleasant to us, but we should be careful. We should have humility in the judgments that we make. We don't want to say that something God did mm-hmm. is bad, if in fact God did set up the world in this way.
Right. Well, and you know, I find that interesting, just that discussion there, and I'm going to draw a blank on which psalm it is, but I remember reading through the Psalms, and there's one where, you know, the lion is roaring about for its prey,
right.
and God is providing it for it, that it really does have this connotation of God doing that. And God's being praised for that. It's not like, oh, this is awful. How could this be? So
exactly.
It's not as trivial to think about this issue when you're really wrestling with what Scripture has to say about it, sounds like.
I think that's right. I think that's Psalm 104.
Yeah.
And the lions and then a few other carnivores are in there too. So yeah, and Augustine looks at that. He acknowledges the struggle of that.
Mm-hmm.
But he basically has this idea of temporal beauty, which is just a way of saying some things are beautiful for a season.
Okay.
And so he's basically saying death can be a good thing in that it leads to a certain kind of beauty. He calls it the lowest form of beauty.
Okay.
The metaphor that he uses at one point that I think is helpful is like the passing of seasons. He has that idea for the whole natural order. Death allows God to create more kinds of animals,
mm-hmm.
more individual animals, and it leads to a kind of beauty in the passing from one thing to another.
So the beauty isn't necessarily in the death, but the death is part of a bigger thing that God's putting in place that is beautiful.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, and he really wants to caution people in the judgments they make about that, because he's saying, look, you're seeing one thing, mm-hmm. but look at it in context. Look at this one instance in relation to the bigger picture. And this is one of the things you guys at Reasons to Believe helpfully point out a lot is, okay, it might be sad for the gazelle when it gets eaten, but think what would happen if it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there was no death of any kind, what kind of world would that be? It would
right.
not be an inhabitable world. It would not be possible because it would be extremely overpopulated very fast.
Yeah, it would look very different than what we see, and we assume that it would be better, but I actually find it interesting is that there are scientific studies that shows what happens when carnivores aren't around, or when the things that are designed to degrade debris are not around, and it doesn't end up well. So it's just interesting that concept of humility. It's, you know, we have this presumption of what it will be, but often when we look in, it looks different.
Exactly, and he uses a great metaphor to kind of impress upon us the need for humility.
Mm-hmm.
He says, imagine that there's a layperson going into a mechanic's shop,
right?
And they don't know what any of the instruments do. They're
right.
not a mechanic. But they cut themselves on one of the instruments as they walk by.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that experience, they say this entire workshop is evil.
Okay.
Well, they're making a judgment based upon their own personal momentary pain mm-hmm. without a consideration of the whole point of what these instruments are doing. Mm-hmm. They don't actually know what they're designed
right,
to
yeah.
do. And Augustine uses that metaphor in this context to talk about carnivores mm-hmm. and say we should be careful in the judgments that we make because we don't see the bigger picture that God sees. And I think that's a simple point, but mm-hmm. I actually think it's a really helpful point to remember in these discussions.
Yeah, it seems like that is a great takeaway. It's like, you know, rather than getting, let's stick on the details, to step back and see, okay, what's God revealing and how do we deal with that? You know, Gavin, I appreciate your comments. They've been very helpful
today.
Thanks,
Jeff.
You know, when you're wrestling with creation and you're arguing that the earth is 4.5 billion years old, you must deal with this topic of death and creation. And we're so often inclined to make the judgment that death is bad. But I do think when you step back and look at a bigger picture of what God has revealed throughout Scripture and what Christians throughout history have said, that the theology that goes into death and what's going on, that I think there is a bigger picture there, that though it's a tense and difficult issue, that there is a way to really wrestle with that and see the beauty that God has put in creation, even if death is there. You know, I would encourage you to go to gavinortland.com and look for his article, The Missing Virtue in the Creation Debates, to understand the importance of humility and getting that bigger picture so that we can go out and share, even in these controversial topics, and have a way to articulate the gospel in a beautiful and powerful way.
That does it for us this week. We hope this episode helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And don't forget, subscribe to our show and search for us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at 2819 Show.
And if you'd like to get the podcast version of 2819, you can get us wherever podcasts are listened to. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.